Oh, wow.
Dude. Like, on the real, I don't know what happened. All I saw was your face was, like, frozen, then a circle started happening. It probably was on my side, because I live in the country, so.
I'm shocked, because we were doing fine, and all of a sudden we didn't change anything, and all of a sudden we weren't working.
Exactly. I didn't know what happened. Yeah.
Well, this is going to be part two.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'll take it. I'm just glad you're back. You know, picking up on what we were talking about the first album. And I was talking about, I don't know if you heard my last question, but it was, what was it like being a conscious rap group with gangster rap kind of infiltrating and hardcore hip hop kind of infiltrating? What was it like being up against that in a way?
Well, my thing was this, man. You know, I'm from Milwaukee. There's a lot of gang violence there. There's a lot of poverty. It's a lot of oppression. And so the disparities are very much in my. So coming from that atmosphere.
Oh, man. God.
It's freezing again.
Yeah. Do you have bad reception?
No, mine is good. Like, I can hear you fine. I can see you fine.
You just froze a little bit on me.
Okay.
I'll try moving a little bit just in case. I don't know if it's me or you. How are you now?
I'm good. I see you perfectly. It's all good.
All right. Well, just keep talking now.
So coming from where I'm from, the disparities are very clear. And I knew that there needed to be music out there that was speaking a different pathway. Speaking for solutions, speaking about things that were uplifting and encouraging, and showing, like, shedding light in darkness. You know what I mean? So to me, it didn't really matter how good or bad other artists were doing. It just mattered that there needed to be more of that, you know, more good music and music that was uplifting the spirit. And Public Enemy was heroes to me. They did very well. They were selling millions of records. You know, Jungle Brothers, KRS-One, you know, all of these groups were doing their thing.
Right.
And so I felt like, well, the South, we didn't have any representation like that. And in fact, we didn't have any representation on a worldwide level, you know.
Right.
There was a lot of uphill battles to climb, and I talk about a lot of that on the For the F and Love album, you know.
Yeah, I know.
That's out now. Building from the Bottom, I talk about that. And so, I mean, I think it was an uphill battle, but one that I felt was so necessary to the craft of hip-hop. I felt like we needed to have some more narratives.
You touch on spirituality a lot.
Yeah.
Correct?
Definitely.
Do you have a specific spiritual background, or is it just, what is your spiritual beliefs?
Well, I'm a Christian now.
Yep.
I became a Christian in 1996.
Yep.
But prior to that, like back in the Arrested Development days, I didn't have a particular religion that I practiced. I was just striving to connect with God the best I knew how. I studied the Bible, studied a lot of scriptures with different religious groups, and just, you know, including African religion, Yoruba, things like that. I was just striving to understand, like, what is it all about, you know? And
right.
I was in my early 20s, and but yeah, by the time 1996 came around, I had met a woman who actually auditioned for my solo career, because by 96, Arrested Development was no longer recording, and I was recording solo music. And I was doing really well overseas in particular. In Japan, by far, was my biggest market. And then Europe was doing really well for me, too. So I was about to go to Europe, and I needed a singer. And it was a woman named Nisha who auditioned. She got the job. And long story short, she started talking to me about Jesus more. And it took quite a while, but I studied the scriptures a lot, and I became a Christian based on what I had learned. And so that's what I still am.
Right. I just find it, you know, most people don't find that spiritual belief at such a young age. You know, it usually comes to them later. And for someone like you to be practicing that as a young person in your 20s, whether, you know, Christian or not, any type of spirituality is just not a common thing. Where did you pick that up? Like, where,
you know,
because that's not, like, people want to, young people in their 20s, they want to drink and party and do all this other stuff. They're not thinking about any spiritual path for the most part.
I had seen the truth of the partying scene, you know, like right, I told early. You, yeah, I was in the clubs at age 13 to 18. So I saw,
that's what I figured.
I saw the allure of it and the beauty of it, but I also saw the darkness of it. So right. I was very sober about the nightclub scene by the time I was 18. And right. Spirituality was something that I deeply believed in because I spent a lot of time by myself as a kid, and my mother and father both worked jobs, you know, constantly in order to put food on the table. So my brother was 7 years older than me, so we were not ever in the same school together. Like, you know, he was always in the next phase of his life whenever I was in a phase. So because of that, I spent a lot of time by myself, and I would pray to God a lot because I would walk about a mile from school to home and home to school. And this was in the, you know, 70s where racism was still very overt. And I could have easily gotten snatched, kidnapped, you know, killed. And so I prayed a lot as a response. Like, that was my way of trying to make sanity of my walks and my being out here by myself as a little 8-year-old kid and, you know, walking all of these various blocks and a mile here and there. And so it's like, I don't know, spirituality just made sense to me. And life, I saw so much hardship, and I'd seen so many problems that trust in man wasn't something that I felt was logical. Like, okay, well,
right.
This is the best that they got going on. You know, like, this is the best that man comes up with. And right. I'm like, I think I'm good. Like, I think there's got to be something better. Now, I'm looking at the clouds. Milwaukee's a beautiful city. Like, I lived in Wauwatosa, which is a suburb of Milwaukee. I grew up there. And beautifully manicured lawns and, you know, white clouds, blue skies, a lot of parks in Milwaukee. So there was a lot of things to sort of just think about nature and something bigger than just what man creates. So these are the types of things that motivated me.
That's great.
Yeah.
We need more of that in music.
I agree.
You know, I think we are lacking that heavily, you know, especially hip hop. It worships sometimes the wrong things, you know, materialism, drugs, alcohol, violence, glorifies these things, and stuff like this that we're talking about that saves lives is put to the side. You know?
Yeah, you know, I did a documentary called The Nigga Factory, and it's on YouTube. It's for free. I spent money to create it. To me, it's a powerful documentary. It's a series, actually. It's two parts right now.
Yeah. And
I talk a lot about, well, indirectly, I talk about this worship of materialism, you know, degradation, hypersexualization, you know, gang violence, so on and so forth. So it's like, you know, I talk about these things because I see how they affect us.
Right.
And I see it in a very tangible, real way in my own life and in my community.
Yeah. Right. So the group ends in 96. You go solo for a little bit, but then the group gets back together in 2000, correct? It was a short departure, the grand scheme of things. And you guys have been keeping it going pretty much since 2000, right? Like, you guys are still touring, still putting out records, you know, independently, but you didn't stop. You just took a break. And what was that like going from being a huge commercial record major label act to now we're doing this independent for 20 years? How has that transition been?
The transition's hard. It's very much a learning curve because not only is it transitioning from major label to indie, it's transitioning from analog to digital. It's transitioning from record stores to streaming services. It's transitioning from, you know, hard copies of things to virtual basically an entirely virtual industry. So everything changed. It's one thing if just one thing changed, you could probably keep up with it, but we've been doing this for 30 years, so it's, everything has changed. You know, there's pretty much nothing that is the same. You know what I mean?
Right.
So other than, I guess, the art of just making music is there, but how you make music has drastically changed. Who's involved in making music has drastically changed. What does it take to release that music has drastically changed. You know, so like how much you make from that music has drastically changed. So like all of these things are fundamental sort of pillars that have been totally swiped down, you know.
And you guys were touring with like non-hip-hop acts a lot of times, right? I read what, Simple Minds? that's classic. If people don't know Simple Minds, Breakfast Club. I mean, these are the type, you're playing music. It's not, you know, it's bigger than hip-hop. It's like you're touring with a lot. Tell me some other big acts you've toured with.
Primus, Rage Against the Machine.
Damn.
You know, you name it. I mean, we got a show in 2 days. Driving and Crying from Georgia. You know, we've played with Herbie Hancock, Chaka Khan, Funkadelic, of course,
awesome.
Acts like The Roots. You know, we played for Barack Obama, Oprah Winfrey, you know, Hillary Clinton, so many different. So, I mean, I think that's the blessing of Arrested Development because we always were that sort of ostracized hip hop crew.
Right.
You know, people all knew about us, but we also were sort of on an island by ourselves, you know.
Yeah.
So we would often play, and plus we were a band. So by nature, we would play a lot of festivals where bands were playing. So we would play Lollapalooza, you know, and we opened up, we were right before Fishbone, which is like a, you know, ska band, you know, it's like legendary. And so. And so, you know, it was very conducive for us to play blues festivals, jazz festivals, you know, rock festivals, soul festivals. And it wasn't as conducive for us to rock hip hop festivals because, generally speaking, hip hop is going to have DJs, right? And no bands, no drums, no keys, no this, no that. So a lot of times, you know, they didn't have enough money to support a band that's coming to rock. Or they didn't have the equipment, you know, the backline, as we call it. So in order to rock these shows. So that was another reason. Not to mention, you know, to my knowledge, I'm the first to bring melody into hip hop as far as rhymes. So, you know, it was controversial. Like Run DMC said, you know, I rap, I do not sing. You know what I mean? So one of the mantras of hip hop back in the 80s was that we don't sing, and it was like on purpose.
Yeah. So
then Arrested Development comes in the early 90s, and the first song is, Lord, I've really been real stressed out, losing ground. You know, under a hip-hop beat with scratching and all of this stuff, and it's like, what the hell is going on now? Like, what have the rules changed? And this is pre-Drake days, you know, this is Bones Thugs and all of these different types of acts that would do that. Pre Lauryn Hill, so on and so forth. So I think at the time, too, it was sort of controversial, not to mention, to be honest, we called out a lot of hip hop activities like calling women bitches and hoes. We were staunch against that. Like we were saying live and direct on stage in front of 20,000-30,000 people. That I know, like I would say, I know our peers say this, that, and the third, but we are not down with that. And so I think by that sort of pitted us against the rest of hip hop, you know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like it was, so I think all of that sort of made it hard for us to feel comfortable touring with a lot of these other hip-hop acts, you know.
Yeah, and Public Enemy had the same thing around music and our message. They were saying, you know, put down the 40 ounces, put down the blunts.
Yep.
And hip-hop at that time, they weren't really with that.
Yeah.
They were really like, no, we want to drink the 40s and we want to smoke the blunts, myself included. I'm sober now, but back then, not so much.
Yeah.
So I that was kind of like the uphill battle I was thinking. Like, it's not easy to be who you are in that hip hop environment sometimes, you know?
It's not, because hip hop by nature is a communal sport, you know? And we're all together. And we also were, it was us against the world in the beginning days, where no one expected hip hop to last, you know what I mean? So all of us that loved hip hop were fighting like heck to maintain this art form, and not only maintain it, but elevate it.
Right.
So for then there to be some internal differences, it began to be a little hard, especially as more corporate heads started to take over the culture of hip hop, you know, like earlier on. And I say this in my documentary, Nigga Factory, early on, you did have Public Enemy talking about, like in Night of the Living Bassheads, Chuck D would say things like, you know, shame on the brother that be dealing the same block with my 98 be wheeling. He's saying don't sell drugs in the black community at all. So he's sort of, his view at the time, and him and Professor Griff was like the mafiosa did, like the Italian mob. They were like, we'll never use these drugs, but we'll sell them all day to the niggas and to this, that, and the third. And right. So he took that same, it seems as if they were taking that same stance. Well, we won't sell them in our hood. If you're going to sell, sell out there, sell to somebody else, because we don't want our hood to get, you know, degraded. Then you had KRS-One at the exact same time, same year. This was like in 88. And he had a song called Illegal Business. Illegal business controls America. Ganja business controls America. So his whole thing and that song was talking about how the government was really controlling this whole drug game. You know what I mean?
Right.
So he had a totally different view than Public Enemies. Then you had other acts like gangster acts that was talking up, like Dope Man, for instance, with NWA, that was talking about, look, we're selling it, and in fact, we're gonna have these crack fiends, you know, getting on their knees and sucking our, you know, saying like,
yeah, right.
You know, sis. So it was like there was a lot of different viewpoints on the same subject back in the 80s, and that was great. That's why, to me, it was the golden era of hip hop, because not only was the music diverse, but the subject matter was diverse. But as the early 90s got in, it started to all become, you know, you had to be on the exact same page, yeah, in order to, you know, really be about that, about the game of hip hop in a sense. And that's where I think it started to go down.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, you guys really brought the eclectic side to hip hop that it had not seen, in my opinion. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm not talking about, you know, there was Native Tongues, obviously, but you guys really took the eclectic side with the band and everything and kind of put that on the map, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, there was that's a Sonic, obviously, back in the day, but you guys did it with a different style. You know what I mean?
And as always, like, you know, the Bible says there's nothing new under the sun. And so The only thing new is fusions of old things put together. You know, this old thing and that old thing. So you're right. Like, for instance, we had men and women in the same group. And the only group to do that before us, believe it or not, was Funky Four Plus One. And they were back in the 70s, late 70s. Right. Early 80s, maybe. And then Stetsasonic, first hip-hop band.
Right.
Shout out to Daddy-O and Stet. Love them. And, you know, but we were the second to do it, and we obviously brought a whole lot of other elements to it.
You know,
having an elder in the group, melodic rhyming within the music, all of these things was just new. So it was a bunch of new creativity and new things being brought to the table when Arrested Development came in.
Yeah. So the new album, which I'm shocked by the title because you threw a swear in there. Well, you abbreviated it for the fucking love, I'll say. Yeah. Is that what it is at the end of the day at this point, 30 years later? It's for the fucking love. Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, that's really what
it has doing to be at this point, right?
It does, because, I mean, you know, you're not making tons of money from records anymore. Like, that's not even a thing. So. Right. Really, it was after 30 years of doing this and after being in the forefront of this scene, why are we doing this? And it's for the effing love. Like, and I, you know, for as a title, I could have said anything, but like when I first thought of it, I was like, For the Love. And then I was like, that's horrible. Like, it's just a whack title. Like, it just doesn't feel right. And For the F and Love felt right to me. And it felt like how I feel. You know what I mean? So, yeah. Yeah. I got an interview to do in about a minute.
We'll wrap this up, man. I'm sorry for the technical difficulties.
I'm sorry, too. It wasn't your fault. I don't even know what happened.
Speech, thank you, man. And all the best luck, man. Keep doing your thing, man. And just want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Leeds Edutainment Podcast with Speech of Arrested Development. Thank you, brother. Good luck to you. And hopefully we can build some more down the line.
I would love to do that. I enjoyed the interview. I appreciate your support, man. Always stay strong. Shout out to everybody that joined us today.
All right, man. Take care, bro.
Peace.